Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is Monday. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up here on our Monday edition, we check in with ex-NPR sports reporter Mike Pesca to learn about his podcast. It's called The Gist on Slate. Aileen Bowles of the Lansing City Council will check in here in just a little bit. And women in Michigan's craft brewing industry. Fermenta is the name of a new group of women involved in craft brewing in our state. And we will speak with Pauline Knighton, who is known as a beer liberator. We've got to ask her about that. That's all coming up this hour. To start our show here today, uncertainty continues to surround tens of thousands of Central American refugees seeking asylum in the United States. Federal officials, including the President and Congress, along with the states, are grappling with how to respond to about 57,000 people, many of them children, who have arrived at the U.S. border since last October. The refugees are mainly fleeing drug and gang violence. As Governor Rick Snyder acknowledged recently, some of these refugees already have been transferred to Michigan. More may be coming as some in the state voice support on humanitarian grounds. The refugees' futures will largely be determined after U.S. courts define their legal status. But what laws, statutes, and other considerations will go into that process? To try to answer that question, we're joined by Jason Eister. Mr. Eister is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor, where he is also an associate professor. Jason Eister, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
Before you help us understand this process, tell us just a bit more about your background as an attorney who has been involved in immigration cases.
I've been practicing immigration law for a number of years, and for nearly 10 years I've been assisting unaccompanied immigrant children and other vulnerable immigrants in navigating the complex legal system and trying to help determine their right to continued presence here in the United States. And currently, as you said, I do run the Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy Clinic at Cooley Law School, where I trained students to go up and stand before the immigration judge and both take testimony and also advocate on behalf of our clients.
The ultimate aim of our legal system here is to determine the legal status of each of these asylum seekers. Do our laws require that?
Well, Mark, under the U.S. Constitution, the Congress, of course, is given the right to make the laws governing immigration, and then they give those laws over to the president, and he's given the responsibility to execute those laws through regulations and operational directives, creating the vast number of departments and agencies that oversee this. So, indeed, the laws do require that each individual who is coming to the United States, everyone who's immigrating, we do have to determine what their legal rights are.
Walk us through what's in play then as far as existing laws and treaties and what our responsibilities are according to those laws and treaties. Help us understand a few of the big pieces in play here, please.
Sure. You'd already mentioned asylum seekers. These children are being screened for a number of different qualifications that they may have and which would allow them to remain in the United States. And the first one is asylum. Asylum is granted to an individual who flees their country and has a well-founded fear of return to that country based on a fear of persecution on account of their religious beliefs, their political views, membership in a particular social group, their ethnicity or their nationality. In addition to that, the United States has also signed a treaty called the Torture Convention in which the United States refuses to return individuals who would face torture from their government. Third, the United States has created something called special immigrant juvenile status, where a child is here in the United States and has been abandoned, abused, or neglected by his or her family. He or she has the right to remain here. And then finally, if the child is the victim of a severe form of trafficking, the child has the right as well to remain here.
So there are a number of...
One thing that... Yeah, let me just, and one area that they do not have the right for, we do have something right now, which is called Deferred Action for Child Arrivals. A child who has been in this country since 2007, who has gone to school here or been in the armed forces, that child has the right to remain here under prosecutorial discretion. None of these children would have that qualification.
Now, I take it each refugee's case will be reviewed individually?
That's right. They're reviewed individually and at different points depending on what claims arise. When these children first arrive, and at the present time, some of the children are indeed entering the United States and trying to get up to other areas. Others are apparently running to the Border Patrol agents that they see and grabbing them around the leg and saying, "You know, here I am, I want help." The Border Patrol is our first line along the border, and those agents, it's their responsibility to make a determination, is this child an unaccompanied immigrant child? That's the first decision that's made, and certain decisions are made based on that. If the child is from Mexico or Canada, then within the first 48-hour period, that child will either be given the opportunity to voluntarily return to the country or will be placed in the jurisdiction and the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. However, if they're from Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, or any of the other non-contiguous countries, then they are, if they are determined to be unaccompanied, they are automatically placed with the Office of Refugee Resettlement. From there, the process will continue with determinations being made about whether or not they seem to have qualifications for these different protections that I mentioned. And those will be decided either by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service initially with regard to their asylum application or their special immigrant juvenile status. In other cases, they will be going before an immigration judge.
Jason Eister is our guest. He is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor. How vigorously would the court investigate a refugee's claims?
Sure. The burden is always, the burden is on the applicant to get any immigration rights. And therefore, while the courts will investigate, it is up to the applicant to provide the corroborating evidence to show that one does qualify. And therefore, that brings about the real need for qualified and vigorous advocacy on behalf of these children. It is the first part, for example, of the special immigrant juvenile status is an application is made to a local family court or juvenile court. And there the judge will take testimony, will accept evidence, and make a determination, was this child abused, abandoned, or neglected? The burden is on the child. In each of these cases, the burden is on this applicant. So the courts will investigate, but investigation is not their key responsibility. It is the responsibility of the applicant to prove that the individual is fleeing persecution in each of these other categories.
Well, with so many unaccompanied kids, though, will a lot of these kids, it will fall to the kids themselves to essentially make their case. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. There is a directive from in one of the laws that was passed by Congress that, to the extent possible, the Department of Health and Human Services will seek to have representation for every child, and that typically is pro bono, unpaid-for representation. The challenge, of course, is the numbers have increased so dramatically with this surge that there is a challenge in identifying those individuals. I must say, however, that the American Immigration Lawyers Association has been responding to volunteer attorneys who are members of that organization or trained immigration attorneys who've said that they will get on the plane and fly down to Texas or wherever it may be and assist in representation. The real challenge is that one cannot just walk into the court and start representing. There is a sophisticated amount of fact gathering, of evidentiary gathering that's necessary in order to make a strong case for these children, in order to understand what the truth is, and that takes time.
I did read a report. Well, one other question. Jason, does a single immigration, does an individual immigration judge finally determine legal status?
In many of these cases, that is correct. The decisions are made by an immigration judge sitting in the location where the child is residing, or, as we're doing more and more now, by video conference from an immigration judge. And one of President Obama's moves was to create more immigration judges to deal with this right now, and also to increase the amount of video conferencing that would be available to assist in more rapidly determining these cases. Right now, it's determined by the by Congress that it's perhaps taking, I think, 587 days to adjudicate these cases in immigration court. Then that's not just the children's cases, but all cases. There's a severe backlog right now, a shortage of judges. In Michigan, for example, we previously had 4 immigration judges, and now we're down to 2, and we're trying to take care of that through some video conferencing with judges down in Puerto Rico. But there is a real slowdown in our ability to process cases as they exist now, and so this growing influx also creates a growing demand.
I did read a report a couple days ago saying that roughly 3/4 of these asylum seekers are fleeing drug and gang violence, about 75%. Does that suggest to you that the U.S. could likely justify granting refugee status to about 3/4 of these people?
Gang membership and the threat from these gangs and from drug cartels has not historically been well received by the immigration judges. That has been changing, and so it's hard to say whether or not all of these children would receive asylum. They have to show that they are a member of a particular social group that's recognizable, that it does fear persecution. If these children were returned to these countries, would they be persecuted on account of certain beliefs, certain attitudes they have? So not all of that, not the entire 3/4. Another law that does come into play, though, however, is the Torture Convention. And there have been immigration judges who have ruled that certain children, abandoned street children, individuals who are fleeing gang membership, that they do qualify based on the Torture Convention, primarily because of the lack of police protection, but also because of the involvement of the police. Just last month, the U.S. State Department released a travel advisory in which they stated that the National Police Force of Honduras had members who were involved in murder and other crimes, and they said that the criminal elements have impunity throughout much of the country, and therefore they were suggesting that U.S. citizens maybe not visit or be more careful, but it does also lay a pretty strong groundwork to say that these children could face torture should they be returned, either through the police or through organizations that the police are unable or unwilling to control.
There is we've got less than a minute, Jason. I want to get working one more question. There is a funding issue in play here, too, which you alluded to a minute ago. Last month, President Obama requested $3.7 billion, in part to get more judges to the southern U.S. to start this process. The Congress is considering much less. Do you understand the role additional funding plays in this?
Well, this certainly is a funding question, because you have coming to the fore two different issues. One, that these children need protection until their cases are determined. And secondly, that the cases do have to be decided. We don't have enough judges to make the decisions, and we don't have enough places for individuals to stay for extensive periods of time. And both of those require more funding.
Jason Eyster is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor. We appreciate your being with us today, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. NPR is a top-level platform for any radio reporter, but for some, leaving NPR has led to projects in the online world of podcasting. One of those reporters who left NPR to launch a podcast is Mike Pesca. He's hosting a daily show for the Slate website. It's called The Gist. The show typically includes one or two interviews on subjects in the news and topics that interest Pesca, and then Mike wraps up each episode with a monologue he calls The Spiel. Listeners from his NPR days will remember his work for being both literate and smart-alecky. The Gist gives him a 5 days-a-week platform where those qualities have blossomed. Current State Scott Pohl recently spoke with Mike Pesca about leaving NPR behind for the world of podcasting.
Mike, I wanted to start by making sure our listeners know about your podcasting history, that along with your new podcast, The Gist, you've also been involved for a while with a sports-related podcast called Hang Up and Listen. Can you tell me about what got you into podcasting?
Well, before Hang Up and Listen, I was the first NPR person to have his own podcast, and that was called Mike Pesca on Gambling. Guess what it was about? Yes, you're right. It was about gambling. And I would interview, say, John Daly, who was a golfer who had a gambling addiction, or I would kind of break down numbers. And in fact, in my show, The Gist, yesterday, I talked about how the World Series of Poker relates to air missile defense. So then a few years ago, Andy Bowers, who came to run what would be the Slate podcasting empire, if you will, came to me and said, you know, we want to start a sports one. We have a politics one. We have a culture one. We think sports is the next big one. Josh Levine, our sports editor, is very excited to do it. We want you to be a panelist. I said, absolutely. Let's see if NPR allows it. NPR allowed it. And there we went. So for a couple years, we did that. And then I think based on our long association and the success of that and how well I work with Slate and how much I enjoyed it, The Gist came. I don't think The Gist would have happened if it weren't for how well Hang Up and Listen went.
I'm not sure a lot of our listeners know any detail about your departure from NPR. What are you comfortable with telling us about leaving NPR?
I worked for NPR for 10 years, the last five or six of them as a sports reporter, and it was great. It was in many ways a dream job. I went to, six World Series, six Super Bowls, bunch of NBA Finals, World Cup, and Olympics, and I like sports, and it's a job. You know, maybe some people say, oh, that's my dream job. It sounds like a vacation. It's not a vacation. It's a job. You know, after the World Series is done, you could go out for a beer. I have to go back to a crappy hotel room and write until 4 o'clock in the morning, but that's okay. It's a job. It's a good thing to write about. And I really enjoyed it. And for a couple years, Slate said maybe we, or Andy, who runs the Slate podcasting empire, said, why don't you come and do a daily show? I'm like, this is what I always wanted to do. The one thing I'd want to do besides having that great beat at NPR is to have my own show. And, you know, there are some restrictions on what you could do on public radio. And it just seemed like podcasting had so much freedom and represented a lot of opportunity. On the other hand, there are limitations, like when you're on NPR, 10 million people hear you. When you start a podcast, it could be that no one hears you. But I weighed it all out, and I decided that it was time to make the move because I had done what I had been doing for a long, long time. I was good at it. I'm not saying I maxed out my learning curve, but it became a thing that I had done for quite a while, so I wanted to do something new and something really engaging and something that used a lot of creativity and a lot of brain power. And so like Scarlett Johansson in that new movie, I think I'm using now 11% of my brain or something.
How has your work changed? I know one way that it has changed in a big way is that you get to swear on your show now, but do you get to set your own schedule? Do you work fewer hours?
Well, it's not just swearing, Scott. It's the nudity. Now, you can't see that because it's a podcast, but like HBO, it's a premium model. The hours are dictated by the fact that the show is demanding, and people, you'll understand, and people who understand public radio get the heavy lift, people, or even any radio. Maybe some people say, well, you know, Rush Limbaugh broadcasts for 2 hours a day. You're doing a half hour a day. What's the difference? And the difference is that I really hold Obama's feet to the fire. No, the difference is that when you open a mic and just start spewing out your ideas, that's one form of broadcasting, and there are a lot of people who are great at it. But we do highly edited or fairly fairly highly edited interviews. We have a lot of production in our show. So I always think of it as our show is about 25 minutes. It's about a quarter of All Things Considered when you factor in, you know, the underwriting credits and when you factor in maybe the news break. It really is about a quarter of All Things Considered's workload. Now, we have exactly two people on the show, Andrea and myself. All Things Considered would have, I don't know, they have 20-something people just working on the show, and that doesn't include all the reporters everywhere, and that doesn't include, you know, member stations that they get pieces from. So it's kind of crazy when you think about how heavy a lift it is. So that means that, I'm pretty much dedicated to always being plugged into everything that's going on in the news, to, you know, writing everything that's said on the show. I write myself. Every interview, I prep myself. Andrea is a great booker, a great cutter, a great conceiver of ideas. But, you know, I'm doing absolutely everything on the show. So it takes up quite a lot of time, but more like an intense time, more like, you know, an intense 8 hours a day. And then the my other 10 non-sleeping hours are pretty much spent a few hours with the kids and the rest just kind of consuming media to be interesting on the podcast the next day.
I wonder about getting through to people you'd like to interview. I suspect that when you called someone back in your NPR days and introduced yourself as Mike Pesca from NPR, they took your calls. Do you have any trouble getting through to some of the people you'd like to talk with?
Well, some of the old people remember me, which is good. Some of the people went, you know, I think that there are some people who are really plugged into what podcasts are and they get it. NPR definitely has, you know, a more extensive brand name. I book comedians and they'll come around, you know, eventually they'll do a lot of comedians like podcasts. I just know that if I was saying, hey, I'm NPR calling and I want to interview you for 15 minutes, the answer would be yes, I'm there. There'd be a knock at the door and it'd be them. Booking's in some ways a little harder. But we have to book smarter. Another thing is getting people into studios. That could take up so much of our budget. So it has annoyed me. I wouldn't say annoyed me, but I liked an in-studio interview sounds better and the rapport in person is great. So I've developed this thing where I kind of have regulars, and if they could come in and we could play off each other in real life, that really works out well. It's you know, it's not NPR. It's not ABC News. It's not MSNBC. It doesn't have the global reach of a, you know, multi-million dollar, verging on billion dollar news empire. We are bootstrappers, but, you know, there's a lot of good that comes of that, too.
What kind of audience reach have you reached yet? Do you know yet?
Yeah, we get hundreds of thousands of listeners a week. You know, if you add up the listeners to our every day and it's a daily podcast, we have pretty high ratings. If you would compare it to a mid-sized city, we'd be, you know, the number one or two talk show, comparable to the ratings of the number one or two talk show station. And those stations are all making a lot of money. So we're an advertiser-supported medium. And so far, that model's really working out well. And, we just see a pretty bright future of more and more people wanting to advertise on the podcast because it reaches a lot of people. It reaches a lot of people. It reaches, you know, the right people, I guess you would say, demographically. Advertisers mostly would rather reach younger people. And there's something about podcasting that kind of makes it the case that, you know, very few people over, say, 65 listen to podcasts, although I've convinced my parents to. But the other thing is the engagement with a podcast. It's sort of, I mean, people, NPR knows that their underwriting credits maybe even go further than regular commercials because people are so identified with NPR. And if they hear someone advertising or what NPR calls taking out underwriting on NPR, there's what's called the halo effect. You know, just by being and supporting NPR, a corporation who takes out underwriting gets a lot of credit from NPR listeners. Man, I think podcasting is like that times 10. Like, there's such an intense emotional connection between a podcaster and his audience or her audience. And I think the advertisers really begin to feel that. And the few advertisers who have ventured into advertising on podcasts have really, really been rewarded. You know, it's practically made some companies.
When you weigh all the factors, Mike, including enjoying what you do and your schedule and, not unimportantly, your income, are you glad you've made this change?
I totally am glad I made this change. You know, the income's an important part of it, and I'm doing well. Thanks for caring about me. But I'm doing quite well. I left NPR knowing what the salary would be, and I was happy with it. And yeah, it's just, I feel there were times, at NPR when I would come back from, you know, covering an All-Star game and talking to a bunch of professional players. Or, like, I went to the Olympics and I interviewed a bunch of athletes about the metric system. I'm like, what a crazy job I have. Well, you know, those were the good days. And then some days on NPR, there are no terrible days, but some days it was like, all right, you have to do a spot on, you know, the results of some trial, some, you know, member, some professional athlete did something wrong, so we need a few spots on that. Or, hey, your story, your 4.5 minute story got cut down to 3.5 minutes, which might not seem like the end of the world, but, you know, oh God, it was just so frustrating at times when great stuff had to go. But you understand, that's the clock, and I don't have to deal with any of those frustrations now. In fact, I was just saying to someone that there's almost no part of my day that's not something that, you know, I don't choose to do and that I don't enjoy doing. So I'm fully engaged. It's really a great working environment. If I'm interested, the show is interesting, and I'm always interested, and I've gotten great feedback from listeners on the show. So it's like unbelievably engaging, taking up a lot of my creativity and skill. And, you know, I feel, if I was the kind of person who used such phrases, I would say I feel blessed to do it.
Mike Pesca, host of Slate's The Gist podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Mid-Michigan's news destination for the informed, the caring, and the curious. It's Current State from 90.5 WKAR. Do you have an unwanted car in your house? One that's maybe given you years of good service? It can do one final good deed. You can donate that to WKAR. Your donation will help pay for your favorite WKAR programs like Current State, like Morning Edition, All Things Considered. To learn more, go to WKAR.org, and we appreciate it. A-Lynn Bowles is currently serving as president of the Lansing City Council. It's her third tenure as president, and it's her seventh year on the council. The Lansing native and University of Michigan alum represents the city's third ward, which covers its southwest part. Lately, the city council has been more involved in changes at the city-owned Board of Water and Light. On Friday, A-Lynn Bowles joined us to talk about those changes and other city issues. I first asked her how she feels about a proposal to expand the BWL Board of Commissioners by 3. That's an issue voters could approve in November.
I think it's absolutely prudent and appropriate to do it this time. We certainly want to have the voters weigh in on the representation that we have throughout the region, and we want to be good neighbors. Obviously, there are ratepayers that are outside of the city of Lansing, and they would like a voice and a seat at the table. Maybe not a vote, but certainly a voice, and we'd like to know what the citizens of Lansing think should happen with that.
The other component here is to delegate Mayor Bernero greater authority during emergencies involving the utility. What do you make of that move?
I think that we've got to have some very specific focal point and person at the helm. And in this case, the first crack at this is to recommend that Mayor Bernero is that person, or the mayor that is seated in Lansing is that person, to be able to rally everyone together, put the conversations on the table that need to happen, to make the crucial and critical decisions that need to be made in those times of crises, takes someone specifically having the buck stopping with them. And I think that that gives the opportunity to do just that.
These moves would require amending the city charter. Is that problematic for any reason?
Not on this. It's very specific. The language was vetted and reviewed by our law team. And going forward, it will allow for future review of how it's working. And I think that's extremely important. I don't think you make a decision that then lasts into infinity and beyond. I think it's extremely important to have a regular revisit of how we are functioning and able to process the work and the responsibilities that any particular entity has.
The BWL board has just announced David Price will be its new chairman. What do you make of the change at the top of the board governing the BWL?
I think they have regular change, and it is certainly good. I have had a chance to have several conversations with Chairman Price and his vision for transparency and communication and accountability, I think, is perfect for the day and hour that we are in. So I think having some fresh eyes, fresh legs in the seat as chairman will allow some forward movement on the behalf of the board. And I think that's good. It's great to have that type of forward movement.
The Lansing State Journal reported that the BWL board violated state law a few months back by discussing a raise and a contract extension for General Manager Peter Lark only through emails and phone calls and not in public meetings. Do you agree? Did they violate state law when they did that?
The Open Meetings Act is very clear on the publishing of meetings and the ability for the public to be able to address those that represent them. And I think that's extremely important to follow. And I think in this instance, it did not allow for the public input that is necessary in such a major decision that is being made or considered.
Do you think they broke state law then?
I think it did not comport absolutely with the Open Meetings Act. Certainly, we have taken a number of classes through MML as a council that talks about the Open Meeting Act and us even deliberating while in a meeting via email or Facebook. And so that's been under scrutinization for a long time. And I do think that when you do not allow the public and the greater larger audience to participate and observe even the deliberation process, then you are in violation.
Aileen Bowles is our guest. She's president of the Lansing City Council here on Current State. Going a bit further back, there were also calls for Peter Lark's resignation after the botched response to the ice storm. For the record, were you one of those people?
I was certainly one of the people that said it would be very, very difficult for him to repair the damage that was done and rebuild the trust, seeing that he was at the helm when the trust was broken. I think it's difficult for the person that made the decisions that were so detrimental to so many people to fix that.
But did you call for his resignation?
I didn't. I was not in a position to call for his resignation. I said that I thought it would be very, very difficult.
You could have called for his resignation.
Not as president of city council, as far as having any type of authority over Peter Lark. That wouldn't have effectuated. It would have come from his board. So as far as my position, it has always been it would be very, very difficult for him to repair the relationships that have been so sorely severed and the trust of the public, and he is seen as the face of the problem. I say even to this day, that is going to be a very, very difficult hill to climb.
Some say the board had become far too deferential to the utilities management. Do you agree with that?
I think there had been some of that, and I do believe that the board had a real wake-up call with the intense outcry from its rate users and the general public around the greater Lansing area. So I think it was certainly a wake-up call for the board.
Last week, the City Council held one of its quarterly joint meetings with the BWL board. What came out of that meeting?
We were able to discuss some solutions to tree trimming, which has become a point of contention for a number of neighbors, the company that is being used, the lack of labor representation through that company, the fact that the company is housed or located outside of Lansing, although we're told that they employ Lansing workers, was a large part of the discussion. Also, there being a call for us to have the right tree service who handles the tree cutting for the Board of Water and Light as a contract organization or company to come in and meet with council and hear some of our concerns directly. We shared pictures and stories and examples with the staff members that were present at the meeting. about some of the poor customer service that was being exhibited by the company. We also talked about rate increases and the upcoming September meeting that will discuss rate increases, possible rate increases. And
what do you expect to come of that?
Well, council's concerns were, have you filled in the gap and taken this opportunity to rebuild the trust that is sorely lacking at this time of BWL? And giving some examples of how that could possibly happen, how we can get the information out that they, in fact, received 168 recommendations between their own review, the CRT review, and other entities weighing in on what needed to change within the Board of Water and Light. And the fact that they have addressed 100 of those 168, and that 68, some of those 68 are going to be ongoing long-term review and adjust and readjust types of fixes. That hasn't been touted. No one has explained that we heard you. We are moving forward as we thought, efficiently and effectively. So we talked a lot about, before you ever have the conversation or discussion as a board about a rate increase, you would want to rebuild that trust and fill the gap that exists right now between what happened and moving forward. And the storm of December 2013, many people are still stuck back there at the storm and its consequences and all of the aftermath of that storm. They are still literally there and reliving it and paying the bills from it and still picking up debris from it. And so to move them from that to you need a rate increase, albeit if it's warranted with the list of reasons of why you need a rate increase, there is a massive gap that needs to be filled. And this is the perfect opportunity, as our vice president indicated, to build, rebuild that trust, and that needs to happen before you ask for a rate increase, we felt.
Would the utility be seriously hampered without the rate increase?
That was a part of what we asked. One of the, my colleagues, council member Wood, actually asked, have you already passed a budget with a rate increase included? And the answer was yes. For us, that was very, very disheartening, and it said to, I think, any resident and any rate user that they have already made the decision and that it doesn't matter what input they give at this upcoming public hearing, that they're going to move forward with a rate increase. And we also indicated heavily to the board and its representatives that that was a misstep. And that is what also creates a further mistrust. And so that was a large portion of our discussion. And we think they heard us. We think that
can
there will be.
Can you do anything about that now? Can the council do anything about that now?
Council cannot. That is in their board's hands. And we, one of the reasons we had such an extensive discussion, but what can happen and what we called their board to task on, and I believe that they heard us and that they are going to take it to heart, that they would take pause and actually have the conversations one-on-one with the individual residents that they represent and ask them to weigh in as they consider and do their due diligence and deliberation to make their vote on if, in fact, they're going to vote to have a rate increase.
And a public hearing is still scheduled?
Correct.
What would you expect to come of that public hearing?
I would hope.
This sounds like the cart before the horse here. The public hearing trails the decision to increase the rates.
Yeah, the public hearing trails the actual budget cycle that said we included this in our budget. The budget would, as I understand it, would be affected if the rate increase did not go into place, the amount of return that they would receive. So they'd still be able to function. They'd still be able to move forward. It would just close the margin and close the gap between the amount that they saw as an increase to the budget or to their bottom line and their amount that was not there. So,
but I want to make sure I understand here. The public hearing that is still scheduled to take place is over a proposed rate increase.
Correct.
That is already baked in the cake.
It's already baked into the budget, correct.
Yeah. Aileen Bowles is our guest, president of the Lansing City Council. I have to ask you about a City Pulse report here just a few days ago concerning a host of serious problems at South Washington Park, a 248-unit low-income housing development managed by the Lansing Housing Coalition. Violence, guns, drugs, bed bugs, according to the story. It goes on at some length. You represent that ward. You told the paper that you were told, quote, "We were moving in the right direction. I've gotten no calls from residents there that I know of," unquote. Have you learned anything more about the conditions at South Washington Park?
Was able to certainly have a conversation via email with the director of the Lansing Housing Coalition and ask again what happened to the funding that we had in place for security, and was told that that funding was removed and that in its place cameras have been put up and that cameras are being used to monitor the safety in the building. Was also then told that we have a community policing officer or police officer that is assigned to the building that they are working with. They are aware of some of the concerns as far as safety goes and propping doors open and individuals that are in the building that, in fact, may not belong in that building, and they are working on that. We have had a cyclical process with this particular location. We have ebbs and flows where we have greater concerns, and then those are addressed. They seem to calm down. Individuals that are creating mayhem or difficulty within the building are removed from the building and or are barred from coming to the building, and it quiets for a bit, and then we have an uptick again. We have some reoccurring issues, and getting to the bottom of those and having a permanent resolve to them has been problematic, to be quite honest.
What's your plan?
My plan has been to go over, walk the building, have some conversations and with the residents, which typically I think some of the residents who were accustomed to contacting my office when we dealt with some of the issues previously are no longer in the building. So I think some of the individuals that are frightened, that don't feel comfortable, that have concerns, have not learned that they have some other resources. And so I'm going to go and make sure that they are aware that they can contact my office, that we give them the name of the community policing officer, and just open the doors for communication and for them to feel like they have an outlet for someone to be able to be of assistance. I also plan, as I have, to stay in direct contact with the exec director of the
Lansing Housing Coalition.
Yep, the Housing Coalition.
Have they dropped the ball here, Aileen?
I don't think they've dropped the ball. I think that they have very steadily worked at the problems, and the problems have morphed from one heavy area of bed bugs to another of individuals who shouldn't be living there, that are living there, that aren't on the lease, that should be on the lease, to getting that round of people out. And then individuals living in the location not being willing to cooperate either and identify the individuals that are in the site that should not be. And it's an ongoing problem, and they've got their hands full. I will say that. Can they certainly do more? Can we put our heads together and find other ways to try and address some of these reoccurring issues? Of course we can.
Are the resources necessary to deal with this in place?
Absolutely not. That's a part of the difficulty. We move from having a security officer and having the funding for a security officer that then was removed because HUD said you can't have that. And then you are now scrambling, which I believe has caused the resurgence and the uptick in some of these problems. You're having a scramble to put other safety measures in place. And that's the place where we are right now. And I believe it'll happen. And I think it's just going to take some additional time and work to make sure that we make that particular site safe and a quality living experience for those that are there.
Aileen Bowles, our guest on Current State, president of the Lansing City Council. The social justice organization Action of Greater Lansing has issued a call to formally welcome young Central Americans to Lansing. They put a proposal before the council to ratify this formality more or less. But there were hostile protests and counter-protests in Lansing about 3 weeks ago over immigration. If some of the young Central Americans were to come here, would you be concerned about resistance to that?
I would not. I think we have a welcoming, loving, family-oriented community with generations of families here in Lansing. And I think what's important at this point is to educate those individuals that were concerned and had such intense opposition to them even having the option to come to Lansing. I think there needs to be some sensitivity and training with those individuals. I think there needs to be some conversations and education of those individuals that are so adamant about their opposition to these individuals being offered harbor here in Lansing during their a very, very difficult and tumultuous time for them. So I think the love and support in the city of Lansing far outweighs the individuals that have expressed their desire not to have them come. I think the love and those that want them here or want to offer our city as a welcoming environment far outweighs that.
Aileen Bowles is president of the Lansing City Council. She represents the city's third ward, which covers the southwest part of the city. Aileen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. One of the many things we Michiganders take pride in is our craft beer industry, which is often cited as one of the best in the country. And as this state's craft beer scene expands and matures, women are increasingly playing a more crucial role in the traditionally male-dominated industry. Just last month, a new trade group called Fermenta was launched that focuses on encouraging more women to get involved in Michigan's craft beer industry. Here to tell us more is Fermenta's president and co-founder, Pauline Knighton. Pauline has the enviable job title of Beer Liberator at Shorts Brewing Company, which is based in Bel Air, Michigan. Welcome to Current State, Pauline.
Thank you.
You officially launched Fermenta just a couple of weeks ago. How did this start?
Oh, well, it's kind of been a lot of things going on to get it to start in these past couple months, but a really big, I guess, kind of momentum behind it starting was when I got into this industry and just started meeting more of the wonderful people who work in Michigan's craft beer scene. And Stacy Roth, who is a brewer at Griffin Claw Brewing Company in Birmingham, the two of us got together at a beer conference and started talking about women in the industry and kind of decided that there's a lot of possibility with collaboration across the state. And Stacy's always wanted to put together a female professional focused group for the state in the beer industry. And so we decided, well, let's get it started. And we've just gotten more and more momentum and women interested and started to actually form a formal organization.
What are your goals?
So one of the biggest things and kind of the foundation of the group is education. And so a goal is to kind of continue education, not only in the craft beer industry, but also all of the alcoholic craft beverage industries in Michigan. So having people be able to learn not only about craft beer, but mead, cider, spirits, wine, to kind of further their knowledge base, which ultimately will strengthen this industry. So education is a huge part of it. But some of our other goals are providing networking and camaraderie among women in Michigan.
What kind of interest have you generated so far?
I'd say a pretty good interest. We've been every day getting new emails from women who are interested in joining. There's about 80 women at the moment who have kind of actively reached out to us in these past couple weeks to join. And so what we're doing is on August 24th, we're going to have a kind of a big launch event that will actually talk about the different membership opportunities. And we're getting a lot of positive feedback for people who are interested in coming to that event. So I would say right now we're really starting to grow that membership base and doing very well.
What's the climate like for women in Michigan's craft beer industry?
You know, it varies. And I think if you ever talk to different women from different areas of the industry, they may have their own stories. Overall, it's very positive. And at least from my experiences, it's been very positive. This industry is very collaborative, and that is with, you know, all people who are interested. There's no doubt that at the moment, women are still a minority, and we'd like to continue to grow because there are so many women who are interested and would like to kind of take that next jump of getting more into a professional job in the industry. But it depends. Overall, like I said, it is positive. It is welcoming. But there's always situations where when you are a minority, you know, you may feel uncomfortable, more uncomfortable in the sense of feeling open to ask questions or to feel like it's okay that maybe you don't know as much as you would like to. But in general, it's a very collaborative industry. And if anything, we just want to be able to grow our presence.
Pauline Knighton is our guest. She is a beer liberator for Schorz Brewing Company and the president and co-founder of Fermenta, which is a new trade organization designed to encourage more women to get involved in Michigan's craft beer industry. How did you get into craft beer, Pauline?
I guess I got lucky. I graduated from college and started finding a passion for the industry, a passion for the products, and grew up actually going to Schorz Brewing Company with my family because we have a cottage not too far from it. And so when I decided that's the industry I wanted to do, I applied for a job there and got very lucky that they brought me on board.
Are you modeling Fermenta after any other similar groups?
Well, there are some current groups right now. Pink Boot Society is an international organization for women in the craft beverage. They're also a nonprofit and so very similar to what we'd like to put together. The reason we haven't gone towards Pink Boots is because we would like to welcome other industries, like we talked about previously, the spirits, the mead, the wine, the cider. And so we've decided to create our own organization. However, there are other Michigan female-oriented groups, and the Detroit Draft Divas are one, and then the Pussycat Beer Guild, which is through Hopcat. And so those are groups that we would like to work with and to kind of be kind of an umbrella for all the different groups that are currently formed in Michigan.
What single goal would you most like to accomplish here next, Pauline?
I would say that it would be to have a group of women who are part of Fermenta because they want to teach other women and be taught to just grow their personal knowledge, which then ultimately can strengthen the industry on a whole for the state of Michigan.
Pauline Knighton is a beer liberator for Schorz Brewing Company, and she is the president and co-founder of Fermenta, a new trade organization designed to encourage more women to get involved in Michigan's craft beer industry. Thanks for joining me, Pauline. Good luck.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we discuss affordable housing in Lansing. We'll also take a ride along with Uber, the car service app that's been setting up here in the Lansing area. That and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth's our producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Drew Henderson and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR. Thank you.